Your Honors, this case comes before you this morning on appeal from the District Court's grant of summary judgment in favor of IBM against Mr. Larimer's Americans with Disabilities Act and ERISA claim. Your Honors, in addition to answering your questions this morning, I would like to focus on two specific aspects of this case, and those would also be the two specific aspects which the District Court's opinion rested on. The first is the issue of whether or not Mr. Larimer was a qualified individual within the meaning of the statute. And the
why is that important? I don't understand that.
Well, Your Honor,
since he's not complaining about his own disabilities, what difference does his physical state make?
Well, Your Honor, the issue is not so much about his physical
state. So why do you talk about his being a qualified...
Well, Your Honor, the framework that we've been working off...
So you don't mean physically qualified, you mean...
Is he qualified for his job, which is to say, can he perform that job?
It has nothing to do with physical stuff.
No, it doesn't. This is an association case, Your Honor, which is a case of first impression before this circuit. It's been addressed by the 10th Circuit and the 11th Circuit. And the 10th Circuit, in the case of Den Hartog versus Wasatch Academy, which is the case that the lower court used as its framework, and the case that most district courts around the country who have addressed association claims have used, sets out a prima facie case, and the first aspect of that is that the plaintiff himself, who is not disabled in these cases, but rather who has an associate with a disability, is qualified for his job. That's why it matters. In this case, the associates with the disability are Mr. Larimer's twin infant girls. Of course, they can't make a showing that they are or are not qualified to work, being that they are infants. But Mr. Larimer himself has to make a showing under Den Hartog that he is a qualified individual for his job. Your Honor, we believe Mr. Larimer has more than adequately made this showing on the record. The legal standard starts and ends, I submit, with the statute, which says that a qualified individual is an individual who can perform the essential functions of his or her job. Your Honor, this is the standard that all the cases following Den Hartog have used to determine whether or not the plaintiff, not the disabled person, the undisabled plaintiff, is qualified for his job such that he qualifies for protection under this association provision of the ADA. The record is full of facts that indicate that Mr. Larimer was well qualified for his job. Initially, he was hired after a competitive process. IBM didn't have to hire him. Certainly, at the time of hiring, Mr. Larimer was qualified for his job. Mr. Larimer submitted evidence that his performance reviews were not bad at all. In fact, on a scale of 1 to 4, Mr. Larimer was administered first a rating of 2, 1 being the highest, which was later lowered to a 3, simply because, as Mary Freeman testified in her deposition, there were only a limited number of 2s that could be given out to employees. Even besides that, while he was working at IBM, Mr. Larimer's supervisors thought well of him. His first supervisor, as I mentioned, was Mary Freeman. She got along well with him. She didn't have any problems with Mr. Larimer. His second supervisor, a man by the name of John Freimark, liked Mr. Larimer and thought he was good enough that Mr. Freimark testified that he respected Mr. Larimer, he admired Mr. Larimer, and in fact, because of his high opinion of Mr. Larimer, chose Mr. Larimer to be on a new sales team. Certainly at that point, Mr. Larimer must have been doing his job well enough to gain that kind of respect from his superiors. Furthermore, there's evidence on the record that Mr. Larimer's sales performance was excellent. In fact, on the very day that Mr. Larimer was given the option to be terminated or to engage in some kind of performance plan, he had made a $600,000 sale to the Aon Corporation. The only thing that IBM can point to that Mr. Larimer was not qualified for his job is that in at least one meeting in April of 2001, Mr. Larimer expressed some frustration with his performance. I submit to you that not only does that not rise to the fact that he is not performing the essential functions of his job, but in fact, that shows that he was more than adequate to perform his job. He was taking a critical view of his own performance, which I think any professional person would know is important to your own continued development and to your own adequate performance. If you can't look at yourself and sometimes be frustrated by challenges, perhaps you're not looking hard enough. Perhaps you're not paying enough attention to what's going on. And that, I submit, is the only thing that IBM can point to that shows that Mr. Larimer was not performing up to their satisfaction. Certainly, I would submit that Mr. Larimer was qualified as a matter of law. Mr. Larimer received a $3,000 bonus. He received a raise. IBM thought highly of him until the time when his twin daughters were born. And certainly, at very least, the issue of whether or not Mr. Larimer was qualified is something that...
Well, the qualification issue merges with the pretext issue, doesn't it?
It does indeed, Your Honor, inasmuch as our argument is that the fourth element of the Den Hartog test that we're working off of is that we have to make some kind of showing that basically there is some kind of causal link between the associate's disability and the adverse employment action that was taken. So,
Let me ask you a question. How much has these children's problems cost now? What are the medical expenses?
Your Honor, we have evidence in the record that it is in the neighborhood of $1 million.
And who's paid for this?
That has been paid for by IBM's Blue Cross Blue Shield plan.
So it's just Larimer's loss of a job that you're complaining about?
Well, Your Honor, I mean...
yes or no?
Yes, but that's what any ADA person...
Well, I'm saying yes, but yes, it's the job. You're not complaining that you weren't reimbursed for, your client wasn't reimbursed for these medical expenses.
Well, we're complaining about the loss of the job, but the loss of the job is tied
to... Are you complaining about a lack of reimbursement?
No, we're not.
Good.
No. What we're complaining about is the loss of the job and the violation of the right not to be discriminated against.
What does that mean?
Well, Your Honor, any ADA claimant...
What's loss of the job you're complaining about? What is this additional discrimination?
Well, Your Honor, the loss of the job itself is always going to be the focal point. An adverse employment action...
The only thing that gives rise to damages.
No, it's not.
No,
the discrimination itself gives rise to damages. That's why the statute exists.
I understand. So his damages would not just be his lost earnings, it would be something else?
Well, the damages principally would be lost earnings.
But principally, what's the residuum?
Well, Mr. Larimer has a right not
what
to
is,
be discriminated.
What are the other damages besides the lost earnings?
As far as monetary loss is concerned?
Well, what are you asking for in this case?
We're asking for the actual damages, yes, Your Honor. Are the damages stemming
right.
from...
There's nothing else. It's not principally. It's exclusively.
As far as damages are concerned. But what the point I'm trying to make to Your Honor is that there also is the issue not just of the adverse employment action, but the fact that Mr. Larimer, like every other citizen in the United States, has a right not to be discriminated against because of his association with a person or person with a disability.
That's your claim. That's not your the relief sought.
That's correct. And I, as I said, the relief sought is relief for the loss of the job. But that's the relief sought. That's not the entirety of his damages.
Of course it is.
Well, Your Honor, the person has a right not to be discriminated against.
You're confusing the cause of action with the damages, with the relief. Anyway, forget it. It doesn't matter.
Well, Your Honor, I'm trying not to confuse the two, but I would submit that the two are linked inextricably.
Of course they are, because you can't get damages unless you prove a violation.
But, Your Honor, that's correct, but there are also, what I'm trying to get at, Your Honor, is that the ADA protects certain things besides
if it didn't,
the job.
You wouldn't be able to get damages.
Well, we would, but perhaps in a different venue, Your Honor.
Different venue? What do you mean? Different court?
The idea is, Your Honor, that if it was some kind of wrongful discharge, there would be some sort of perhaps a contract claim involved.
But that's what you're saying, a wrongful discharge. That's your whole case.
But the wrongful discharge is a result of the denial of the
responsible because you're sued under the ADA.
Exactly. Exactly. And the reason you would do that is because of this issue of discrimination. But, Your Honor, just to follow as long as we've entered into the area that you brought up, which is the idea of causation, the notion is that Mr. Larimer has proved that the only reason offered by IBM for why he would be discharged is he was not performing properly.
Right, and if that's pretextual, there's a problem, and if it's not, if it isn't
exactly
a pretext, you have no case. So.
Well, we submit that it is pretext and that it was therefore error for the lower court to grant summary judgment on that issue. Additionally, Your Honor, the lower court, in looking at this case and in analyzing the ADA section,
but why would IBM fire him because of these children? Because they're paying for all these health, all these medical things. So why should they care that? I don't get the connection.
So that they no longer have to pay those expenses. The children are disabled and they will continue to be that way. They'll continue to require medical attention. They'll continue to essentially run up bills on IBM's nickel. And that we
should. Do you think IBM cares about these hypothetical future expenses?
I think they do.
A company this size? I don't understand that. I mean, presumably, you know. They average a company knows occasionally it's going to have some heavy medical expenses. But
that's true, but in a period of about 3 months, these children ran up about $1 million.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean they're going to run up $1 million in the future. They may be fine.
Let me ask about the incentives of the managers who made the decision to fire Larimer. Do the medical expenses of their staff appear on their budget?
As far as the individual managers themselves that are at issue here?
The managers are operating a division that has a budget.
That's correct.
Are the medical expenses of the staff charged against that budget?
I do not believe that there is evidence to that effect in the record yet.
Then what conceivable incentive would they have to get rid of someone in order to reduce medical expenses? If it doesn't affect their budget, why should they care?
Well, Your Honor, I wouldn't necessarily want to. I don't know exactly, and I wouldn't want to speculate as to why. And
I don't really care whether you know. I care what's in the record. And since you have the burden of persuasion, if there's something important that's not in the record, well, that's too bad for you. But what the record shows, just to be clear, that, or alternatively, there is nothing in the record that shows that these expenses are charged to these managers' budget.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Then, let me come back to my question. What incentive could they have to fire somebody in order to reduce the medical expenses?
I'm not exactly sure, Your Honor. And that, I believe that in that respect, we have met our burden.
But if they don't have any incentive to behave in this way, it doesn't seem a plausible inference that they did behave in this way. Well, right, there are two explanations for firing Larimer. One is he wasn't up to snuff on the job, and the other is there were medical expenses attributable to his children. If the managers had no reason whatsoever to consider the second reason, it seems more likely that their real reason was the first.
Well, Your Honor, I submit that there's enough evidence in this record to show that the first reason couldn't have been the reason. It just couldn't have been. And that, therefore, any factual dispute as to the second, as you point out, is something that should have been left to a prior effect.
Sounds like no factual dispute about the second. You haven't put anything in the record that would enable there to be any factual dispute about the second.
Your Honor, I think under Adriani, which is quoted in our brief, I think a trier of fact is entitled to infer.
Do you think they were concerned that he was being distracted from his work by the children's medical condition?
I think that may have been a concern.
Is there any evidence of that?
Yes, I think in one of his supervisor's depositions, John Freimar testified towards those ends.
What did he say?
Your Honor, I don't have it in front of me. I couldn't tell you.
Because that would be the alternative theory as to why they would discriminate against him.
Well, in any event, Your Honor, I would just simply conclude by saying on this last point that I think there's more than enough evidence in the record that Mr. Larimer was well qualified for his job. and that that couldn't have been reasonably the cause for his termination. And as a result, I think summary judgment was inappropriate, and this should have been left to a trier of fact to determine the actual cause, to determine these actual issues, as opposed to being decided by the judge. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Vogel. Mr. DiNardo?
May it please the court. The district court's grant of summary judgment should be affirmed in the first instance because the
Larimer. What do you think is the proper standard for these association claims, these novel claims?
The proper standard, Your Honor, or the proper,
paradigm
for determining whether a case has been made?
Right.
I think you take the McDonnell-Douglas paradigm and you modify it to say, was an action taken against the person who associated with the disabled person under such circumstances that a reasonable inference can be drawn that discrimination may have occurred?
Well, what does association mean?
Well, I think the statute talks about association or relationship, Your Honor. So association, I think, means in the common understanding that you associate perhaps with a co-worker or friends, etc., who are in fact disabled.
Well, what does that mean? I mean, suppose you at Christmas you go to a hospital for disabled children or something and play Santa Claus. Does that mean you've associated with a disabled person?
I think it could, Your Honor. I think that's
ridiculous. I think, right? Because then any time someone was fired, he'd go and say, look, 3 years ago I spent a day with a disabled person, so I associated, therefore McDonnell Douglas comes into play, and that doesn't make any sense.
Well, you have to be known to have associated, Your Honor. And
right, he told his bosses, you know, look, you can't fire me anymore because I just associated with a disabled person.
There was a fair amount of discussion.
I just gave someone who had no legs, I gave him a quarter.
There was a fair amount of discussion around the statute, Your Honor, regarding HIV positive people and AIDS positive people, or people suffering from AIDS.
Shook hands with an HIV positive person.
Or you supported their efforts.
And back away from me, please.
or you supported their efforts.
I don't get it.
The statute, though, Your Honor, and the part of it.
So you regard the slightest, the most fleeting contact with a disabled person triggers McDonnell Douglas, your view.
I don't say it does, Your Honor. I say there has to be, first of all, the employer has to know about it. It has to have some meaning. But in this particular case,
that's the problem. The Supreme Court created McDonnell Douglas itself in order to identify those circumstances where it thought prohibited discrimination more likely than not. If we're to translate that framework to a new statutory area, we have to identify those circumstances that make discrimination more likely than not. And I haven't heard either side address that question. This kind of stuff about visiting people in the hospital and so on has nothing to do with when discrimination is more likely than not.
In this particular case, the facts of this case, Your Honor, it deals with the word relationship.
Look,
the statute.
You can't answer a question about the structure of analysis by pointing to the facts of this case. We're trying to figure out what the structure of legal analysis should
be. In this case, Your Honor, if the plaintiff has a relative, a relationship, who is disabled, they've satisfied one prong of a prima facie case. These are the plaintiff's children. The case fails because the children are not disabled. The district court did not.
I don't know what you mean. Can you have probabilistic disabling? Suppose someone takes a genetic test and for Huntington's chorea and flunks, which means the person has a 50% chance of developing this horrible, obviously disabling disease sometime in the future. So what's the status of that person?
That doesn't work, Your Honor. Supreme Court says it has to be a current disabling condition.
Really?
Yes, Your Honor. Even though it wasn't the principal part of Sutton, which dealt with ameliorating mitigation, in that case,
I don't even understand what that means. If you have arteriosclerosis, you might do fine for the rest of your life and die from an auto accident. So would you say arteriosclerosis can never be disabling?
Not that it can never be, but as you described it, it's not, Your Honor, under the statute.
Didn't they treat infection with HIV? Isn't that considered a disabling?
It certainly can be if it interferes with your ability, not just interferes, makes it difficult to work.
Being infected by HIV.
Yeah. They held that just being infected is enough.
Just the status of infection, having the virus. Asymptomatic, I do not believe that's correct, but I could stand corrected. I don't believe they actually held that, Your Honor, is what I'm saying. I don't believe that. You have to have presently disabling impairments.
Okay.
Exactly. And they have to be substantial, and they have to interfere with the core activities of your life. Absent that, you are not disabled under the statute. These children were deemed...
Please, odd. I mean, what if the company said, what if you had one of these Huntington's cases, and the company said, my God, this person is going to cost us a fortune in a few years. Let's get rid of him now. And you're saying there's no claim there.
If they don't believe mistakenly that the person's disabled, there's no ADA claim.
They believe correctly that he's not disabled now, but he will be in 6 months.
There's no ADA claim. No ADA claim. There may be a 510 claim under ERISA, but there's no ADA claim.
It doesn't sound very sensible, does it?
Well, these statutes apparently are the result of political trade-offs here and there, and as it's drafted, the statute requires that you must be currently disabled.
Well, it doesn't say currently.
Well, actually, it's written in the indicative tense. The Supreme Court has said it means currently, and that is in the Sutton decision. It means currently disabled. It's also in the Seventh Circuit's decision in several cases where this court's addressed it. So there are at least... Well, there's a Sutton case, and then I'm afraid I stopped at the Supreme Court. But there are several cases, Seventh Circuit cases, that we've cited on this point. The impairment must cause a present substantial limitation. That wasn't the case here. The doctors are uniform on that. Dr. Dedish said these children are doing fine. When she assessed them several months after they're at the point of discharge, when she assessed them several months later, the same conclusion. The children were simply doing fine.
Do you think lupus can be a disability?
Depending on the symptoms, Your Honor, yes, it can be.
The characteristics of lupus are that most people are fine most of the time, but then the condition flares up and they can't do anything. So on your view, it would sound like lupus is not a disability whenever you can work, and therefore no accommodations ever have to be made, because when you can't work, then you're not qualified.
Well, during the period that you cannot work...
That can't be right.
During the periods that you cannot work, I believe you are disabled under the ADA.
Are a person if you can work with or without an accommodation. When the lupus flares up, a person can't work and therefore isn't qualified. And when the lupus is in remission, you would say the person isn't disabled. And therefore a condition like lupus would never provide any benefits under the ADA. And as I say, that can't be right.
Well, I think
in fact, it contradicts decisions of this court.
I think it depends on the pattern of the disease. If this is an intermittent thing that comes and goes, and it is disabling when you have it, I think you do have an obligation in that you are covered and you have an obligation to accommodate. These children, the second reason the district court's decision should be affirmed. First of all, the children are not disabled. Secondly, they weren't regarded as being disabled. This court has written a great deal on that. There must be the mistaken belief that the children are in fact disabled when they're not. There's no evidence in this record that there was such a mistaken belief. Most recently in the Airland Transport case, this court again repeated that the employer must believe the person so disabled that the disability incorrectly assumed about the person constitutes a disability under the ADA. Absent that, there is no regarded as case, and we would submit there's just no evidence in this record beyond that the two employer representatives, Freeman and Freimark, they knew of the difficult pregnancy, they knew the children were premature, they knew there were medical complications. That's the state of the record.
How old is Mrs. Larimer?
Early 40s now, I think, Your Honor, so in her late 30s at the time. In terms of Freymark and Freeman, the two decision-making makers, having a motivation for discharging Mr. Larimer, the record evidence, it is in the record, that the medical costs did not affect their compensation. If you look at Freymark's affidavit, which is part of the appendix to IBM's motion for summary judgment, uncontroverted, Freymark says, my compensation was determined by the sales of my group, nothing on the expense side. Freeman was Freymark's boss. Freymark was the person who moved forward the decision to discharge, and then it was approved by Mary Freeman. So the evidence, in fact, is no motivation. And the deposition testimony is to the same effect. In terms of the 510 ERISA retaliation claim, there's two fundamental problems with that claim. Number one, there's no evidence of a conscious decision to interfere with the attainment of benefits here. None whatsoever. And secondly, I'd like the court to consider...
I don't understand. You seem to disagree with your opponent about whether it was $1 million or $200,000 that the...
Yeah, the record confirms, Your Honor, there was $200,000 in medical benefits, about $66,000 for the one child, and whatever will the difference between $66,000 and $199,000. And the person who administered the benefits testified that's in the record. It's absolutely uncontroverted. It was $200,000, unknown to Freeman and Freymark. They had no way of knowing the extent of these bills, et cetera. As I said, they knew there was a difficult birth. They knew the children were hospitalized for a period of time. But in terms of, so the amount is $200,000, that's confirmed. They didn't care about it, these two decision makers. It didn't affect them. They had no reason to care. They didn't know, and they had reason, no reason to know. There's an interesting part of this case, though, at this juncture. The Stone decision in employment discrimination cases says that the way this case proceeded under the McDonnell-Douglas indirect method of proof, that you must compare yourself to someone who didn't complain about discrimination and see what happened to that person, to find the comparable and show the disparate treatment. Now, the 510 claim was not encompassed in the Stone decision. The Stone decision talks about employment discrimination cases, retaliation under the employment discrimination laws, not retaliation under ERISA 510. But recently, a district court in this circuit in the Southern District of Indiana, in the Eli Lilly case that we've cited, extended the logic of Stone to a 510 case. And it certainly fits the analysis. You analyze a 510 retaliation case much like you analyze an indirect employment discrimination retaliation case. And the district judge in the Eli Lilly case suggests that in this circuit now, given Stone, that the same requirement exists in a 510 case. There was no effort by the plaintiff in this case to say, let's look at other persons performing at the same level who did not submit claims in this approximate amount, and let's compare what happened to them. So the 510 case fails because there's a failure of the requirement of ERISA that there be specific intent to deny someone benefits. There's just nothing in the record on that. But secondly, the Stone requirement, which I suggest should apply in a 510 case, just like it would apply in a Title VII retaliation case, has not even been approached here. So the conversation about did the plaintiffs meet the legitimate expectations of the employer, and in that sense qualify for the job, was there any evidence that the employer's articulated reason was not genuinely held? The answers to those questions are the proof fails on those questions, but the district court never got to those questions, never needed to get to those questions, because you have children who fortunately left the hospital 6 weeks and 7 weeks after birth healthy and remained healthy.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Vogel, how much time does he have? No time? Want a minute for rebuttal, or?
No. Just wanted to briefly address something that Your Honor had brought up.
this issue of HIV. The Supreme Court did address it in a case called Bragdon versus Abbott. It's a 1998 case. Mm-hmm. And they ruled that HIV was a disability under the ADA, even though this particular plaintiff's symptoms hadn't progressed to the point where he was really affected on a daily basis. But rather, the HIV itself was an impairment that affected a major life activity. And in this case, the major life activity was reproduction. So I just wanted to bring that to Your Honor.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Bowles. Thank you to both counsel. Next case for argument, Alliance.